there has been quite a bit of press concerning the Big Bang, especially because of the COBE results. And what I would like to do this evening is not only discuss the COBE results, but also give a history of the Big Bang as well. I'll be following the outline pretty closely, and with that, we will begin the slides. I don't quite recall where I received this particular quote, but it says, "It's impossible for any sensitive person to look at a star-filled sky without being stirred by thoughts of creation and eternity. The mystery of the origin and destiny of the universe haunts us throughout our lives." And I dare say, regardless of our interest in science or our interest in astronomy, there have been many a night when we have been away from the city lights and we look up into the sky and we ask ourselves, where did this all come from? And even if the answer to that question is, the Lord made it, I'm sure the sequel then is, what process did the Lord use? And the quest for the origin of the universe, in my mind, is really a quest to find the mechanism whereby God created the universe that we see. By the way, please don't be insulted if I read the material on the slide. I know you can read it, but sometimes people in the back have a little more difficulty seeing the letter. So for that reason, I will read it, and also for the sake of the tape. As I said, we all have impressions of the sky. Here's one impression here by the artist Van Gogh. And whether your impression of the sky is one of artistry or one of science, it makes for a very interesting study, again with the question, how did it all originate? The scripture tells us, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the interesting thing is that this particular verse of scripture had been ignored by many people because of the concept of the beginning, which was repugnant to many individuals who were not theistic in their outlook. The scripture states that the beginning is caused by God, that there has been a beginning. And it's interesting that now in the 20th century, we have the scientific evidence that points towards the reality and the truth of this particular statement. The excitement over the Big Bang, again, has been piqued, rekindled by the COBE satellite. COBE is an acronym, C-O-B-E, stands for Cosmic Background Explorer. One reason it has taken so long to find the recent results in favor of the Big Bang has been because we have not had a long-lasting instrument in orbit above the Earth's atmosphere to be able to investigate the radiation, the light, the radio waves coming in from the Big Bang. COBE was able to do that. It has been up for about 2 years, and we are getting some very exciting results by the satellite. George Smoot is the principal investigator. We see here the title that he has made some startling claims, claims not only concerning science, but also claims concerning theology and how others have reacted to those particular claims is also going to be part of the subject of the talk tonight. The Big Bang, as a result of COBE, received a lot of press, as I said, not only in astronomy magazine, such as you have here, but also in Physics Today. The maps that you see of the universe on the front page are as a result of the COBE data. We'll discuss those more thoroughly in a few minutes. Even obscure journals like Photonic Spectra, a journal that I get at work, had an article on the Big Bang. It says, creation and a lesson for NASA. Basically, the creation part leading to the creation of the universe. The lesson for NASA was that a small, inexpensive satellite, such as COBE, gave us an enormous amount of information concerning the universe, and their suggestion is that NASA should take this seriously, and instead of trying to build a multi-billion-dollar space station, which in effect is going to enrich a lot of congresspeople's districts, they should think of putting less money into satellites like COBE, which is really going to give us some basic scientific information. The other thing, too, that they mention is that the COBE satellite, if you ask what is the practical purpose of knowing anything about the Big Bang, if you're talking in terms of a cottage industry based on the Big Bang, you're probably not going to find that. You're probably not going to find a boost, not going to find a boost to the economy as a result of Big Bang research. but in terms of the information that it gives us about the universe and our own place in the universe, for that reason it is useful. This is the thrust of the article. Time magazine had a very fine summary by Michael Lemonick of the Big Bang, Echoes of the Big Bang. This is the May 4 issue of this year. The COBE results not only rekindled interest in the scientific aspect of the Big Bang, but it also rekindled interest in the theological aspects of the Big Bang. A very interesting article by Robert Jastrow appeared in the July 1980 issue of Reader's Digest. Have astronomers found God? And as a result of the COBE results, and as a result of George Smoot's assertions concerning reaching out and touching the face of God, that particular aspect of the Big Bang has been rekindled. Here's just the inside of the article, and two of the individuals that we'll be discussing tonight are pictured here, Albert Einstein on the left and Edwin Hubble on the right. We'll see their contributions to the Big Bang. Roger Jastrow based his article on the book that he wrote, God and the Astronomers, and it is a very nice historical summary of the Big Bang research, and I'll be following that particular outline in the course of the talk. Here's Robert Jastrow, very good organizer. He was head of NASA for a while down in the Washington area. He has now since retired from that. But Jastrow makes a very interesting assertion in the very first paragraph of his book when he says, when an astronomer writes about God, his colleagues assume he is either over the hill or going bonkers. In my case, it should be understood from the start that I am an agnostic in religious matters. But now here's the very interesting statement that he makes after that. However, I am fascinated by some strange developments going on in astronomy, partly because of the religious implications and partly because of the peculiar reaction of my colleagues. We'll see for some of that reaction. As I said, there's a very interesting interplay between theology and the Big Bang because both subjects deal with origins. But here's what he goes on to say. It's quoted in the Reader's Digest article. The essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. Isn't that interesting that an agnostic would say this? Sometimes it's hard even to find Christians who will actually say this. The chain of events leading to human beings commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment of time in a flash of light and energy. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the Big Bang. The beginning, a cosmic explosion that gave rise to what we see in the universe. I'll have a little more explanation of that later on. He sees in the book, he says, now we see how the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. The details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. The chain of events leading to human beings commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time in a flash of light and energy. And so we come to the scientific material concerning the Big Bang. What is the evidence behind the Big Bang? Our story is actually going to start with Albert Einstein, one of the more brilliant physicists that has existed. Albert Einstein, after some very successful theories explaining the so-called photoelectric effect, his explanation of Brownian motion, and also with his theory, the so-called special theory of relativity, was working on a general theory of relativity. Now, the special theory of relativity describes the physics of very rapidly moving objects. Some very strange things happen concerning the mass of the object, that is, the amount of material that's there. Objects change their shape when they move very quickly. There's some very strange things that go on that we don't experience because we don't move that fast. And after that particular theory, which has been extremely successful, he was working on a general theory of relativity. That is, his general theory was an attempt to explain through mathematics the large-scale structure of the universe. By the way, it's not called the theory of relativity because it deals with aunts and uncles and cousins. It's the theory of relativity, because he's trying to see how some parts of the universe interact with other parts of the universe, or what goes on in one part of the universe relative to other parts of the universe. And so he came up with a series of equations that tie together the distance of objects in the universe, tie together the amount of material there, tie together the shape of the universe. And when he looked at his equations, he found something that was really very disturbing to him. He found that the universe should evolve. That is, it should change. It should either get bigger or it should get smaller. Now, at the time that Einstein came up with his equations, he was living in a scientific milieu which basically stated that the universe was static. That is, the universe, as we see it, has basically been this way from an infinite time in the past and will be that way to an infinite time in the future. By a static universe, we mean a universe that is neither growing nor shrinking, a universe that is infinite in extent and infinitely old. In other words, to Einstein's thinking, there was no such thing as the beginning. The universe has always existed. It will always exist. His equations, however, told him otherwise. He was very disturbed by this. And so he added what we might call a fudge factor into his equations in order to maintain a static universe without origin and without end. But we don't call it the fudge factor. It's called the cosmological constant. But he added it into his equations in order to maintain a universe that lived up to his expectations. Just to jump ahead a little bit, by the work of Hubble, we found that the universe really does expand. And after Einstein believed the evidence of the expanding universe, that is one that's actually growing and getting bigger, he claimed that he had made the biggest mistake of his life. Even though he added the cosmological constant, there were a few other individuals, such as Willem de Sitter, a Dutch astronomer, a Russian scientist by the name of Alexander Friedman, and also a Belgian priest who was a mathematician by the name of Georges Lemaître. And all three of them were able to take Einstein's equations, even with the cosmological constant, and still find solutions to the equation that showed that the universe should either be expanding or contracting. Now, the problem with having an expanding universe is the following. If the universe is expanding, what it means is the distance between the material in the universe is getting bigger and bigger. The expanding universe would mean that the material in it, which goes right along with the expansion, is moving farther and farther apart. Now, you can have an expanding universe and also have it infinitely old, because if the universe had been expanding for an infinite amount of time, all the material would have expanded away one from the other. And so the expanding, the very fact that the universe should be expanding, shows that there should be a beginning. And it was that concept of a beginning that upset Einstein and some other individuals at this time. But his equations, with or without the fudge factor, with or without the cosmological constant, pointed towards a universe with a beginning. The scientific evidence for the expanding universe really begins with this man, Bessel Melvin Slipher. He had finished his graduate work, and he was working on understanding the motion of galaxies. Here's a picture of a nearby galaxy, the so-called Andromeda galaxy. It looks a little bit like a pinwheel, and just as pinwheels rotate on their axis when they're in the wind, spiral galaxies like this also rotate on their axis. Think of the axis as going up to the right at about 45 degrees, and this huge spiral galaxy rotates about that axis, similarly as the Earth rotates about its axis. The only difference is this spiral galaxy is extremely large and contains probably around 400 billion stars, about the same size as our Sun. And all these stars are rotating around a center. And what Slipher was interested in is finding how fast these galaxies rotated. The technique that he used I will describe in a moment, but in the course of examining the rotation of these galaxies, he found something very interesting. The six or seven that he had examined all showed that these galaxies were moving away from the Earth, away from our solar system. And since our solar system is tied into our own galaxy, the Milky Way, what he found is that these galaxies were moving away from the Milky Way. Now, it struck him as strange, because he too was living under the scientific milieu that the universe is constant, that the universe is neither expanding nor contracting, and under those conditions, the galaxies in the universe should be a little bit like the molecules of air in this room. And by that I mean the following. If you could focus in on molecules of gas in this room, what you would find is, on average, as many molecules would be moving towards you as are moving away from you. That is to say, the gas in this room, the molecules in this room, are in constant motion, and they're going all over the place. And the motion of these molecules is totally random. And if it's totally random, on average, you should have as many molecules moving towards you as away from you. Now, try to think of the galaxies in the universe as gas molecules in this room. And if you were to observe the galaxies in the universe, and they are just moving around randomly, which was the thinking at the time, roughly half of the galaxies that Slipher observed should be moving towards our galaxy, and the other half should be moving away. And so it was strange for him to realize that all the galaxies were moving away. It'd be a little bit like standing on a two-way street. If you're standing on a two-way street, all things being equal, you would expect about as many cars going right to left as left to right. Now, we understand that during times of rush hour, or if you have a one-way street, that's not true, but all things being equal. If all you see standing out in Main Street is cars going one way, you'll begin to realize something's going on. As I said, there's a roadblock up ahead in one of the lanes, or it's turned into a one-way street. I mean, something is not normal. And this is exactly the feeling that Slipher had. When he talked to his advisor about this, his advisor said, "Well, why don't you go find a few more galaxies, examine them just to be sure that you're really perceiving a trend." So he went out, checked a few more galaxies, and again, they were all moving away from our own galaxy. He didn't know how to interpret this. He gave his results in the 1914 meeting of the American Astronomical Society, and although people were impressed with his material, nobody could really explain it, except Edwin Hubble, who was at that same Astronomical Society meeting, and he began to tie together Slipher's evidence, scientific evidence, with the theoretical work that had been done by Einstein, de Sitter, Friedman, and Lemaître. And Edwin Hubble, who is considered to be one of the greatest astronomers of all times, you might say that, you know, astronomers have a lot of theories. And in spite of the discussions and the conflict that you get between astronomers concerning their theories, they will all agree on two things. One of them is that Edwin Hubble was one of the greatest astronomers that ever lived, and he made one of the most profound discoveries in the 20th century. The second thing they'll all agree on is astronomers don't get paid enough. Using the Mount Wilson telescope, and what you see pictured here, the Mount Palomar telescope, they needed a large telescope such as this one in order to obtain enough light from these very distant galaxies that he was observing. By the way, let me just mention that this particular telescope, the light comes in from the upper left, comes down, bounces off a curved mirror here, and focuses up at this point. And this mirror is 200 inches across, about 5 yards, a little over 5 yards. This was the largest telescope in the world at one time, but now we have a telescope that is going into operation. It's going to be about 10 yards across. The reason astronomers need such large telescopes is because this kind of work that Hubble did and astronomers are still doing requires the observation of very, very faint galaxies. And so you need a big area to collect the light coming from the galaxies, and then it's focused down to a point where it can be measured. Well, using this particular telescope, and also along with his associate, Milton Humason, that is pictured here, Hubble was able to determine the motion of many more galaxies than what Slipper was able to determine. Basically, the motion of a galaxy is determined as follows. I'm sure all of you have seen light passing through a piece of glass, or perhaps even a prism, such as you see pictured here. What happens? You take sunlight or light from a lamp, and as it passes through a prism, different wavelengths of the light, different colors of the light, get bent at different angles, and you get over here a distribution of light from red down here to blue. Now, this particular distribution of light is what we call the spectrum of the radiation. Now, just a moment. Let me invite some people in who are outside. I'll be right with you. So the spectrum of radiation, when we talk about the term spectrum, what we are talking about is the amount of light that you have and different colors, if we're dealing with light that we can actually see, so-called visible light. Here's a thing to keep in mind on this. You can think of the colors as having different frequencies. That is, the colors vibrate at different frequencies, at different pitches, if you like, and that particular pitch, as it impresses the retina, gives us an idea of the color that we are observing. Red light does not vibrate quite as quickly as blue light. And keep that in mind for something I'm going to say in a moment, but by taking spectra of galaxies and analyzing the amount of red, blue, yellow, green light, etc. that we have, we're able to tell whether a galaxy is in motion with respect to us, whether that galaxy is moving towards us or away from us, and not only so, but to tell how fast the galaxy is moving towards us or away from us. Here's a picture of a spectrum that comes from a very distant galaxy. These lines right here are just calibration lines so that we know the exact frequency, the exact pitch, if you like, of the radiation coming from the galaxy. Now, here's the way it works. Here's how you're able to tell whether a galaxy is moving toward you or away from you. What we do is we check the pitch of the light, and we compare the pitch of the light that we receive with the pitch of the same light that would be emitted if the galaxy were stationary with respect to us. Now, here's how it works. Let me use sound as an example. Here you have an individual who's waiting at a train station, and in the upper frame, the train to the right is stationary with respect to the individual. The train blows its whistle. And now I'm going to put on my best train whistle. It's going to sound something like this. Hoot, hoot. Boy, you'd get out of the way if you heard that coming down the tracks, wouldn't you? So I go, toot, toot. Now, suppose, on the other hand, another train is speeding along, coming towards the individual, and suppose that this train, when stationary, has the same pitch as the stationary train. When the train is coming towards the individual, the frequency increases because the wave that is coming towards the individual, the sound wave that's coming towards the individual, if you like to think of it, gets compressed. Now, the way to think of it is as follows. Think of a spring, and you have the spring that's coiled, and measure the distance between successive coils. Now, this is what we call the wavelength of the radiation, the wavelength of the coil. Now, if you compress the coil, the coils are going to get closer together, and the wavelength is going to get shorter. On the other hand, if you pull on the spring, if you pull on the coil, the coils are going to get farther apart. Now, this is what happens to sound, and this is what also happens to light. Sound works like this. Okay, we start out with the observer and the train that are stationary with respect to each other, and you hear a toot, toot. On the other hand, if the train is rapidly moving towards the person at the station, you're going to hear a higher pitch, and it's going to go as follows. It's going to go from toot, 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 toot. On the other hand, if the train is moving away, then we lengthen the coil, we increase the wavelength, which also the same thing as saying we decrease the pitch, and instead of then hearing the toot, toot, people out there are wondering what in the world I'm doing. Instead of hearing a toot, toot, we hear a toot, toot. Okay, now, how many of you have been at a railroad crossing and a train has been coming by and it's warning you that it's coming? And so it starts tooting its whistle, its horn, maybe a mile or so up the track, and it keeps tooting it as it goes by. And what do you hear? You hear something like this. Toot. Okay? And in fact, if you listen very carefully, even without blowing its whistle, just the noise that the train produces will have that frequency shift as well. Well, I'm working now with sound, but exactly the same thing happens with light. And basically what happens is the following. Suppose you have a galaxy, and suppose that galaxy is stationary with respect to yourself. Now, that galaxy is emitting a certain color of light. If that galaxy now begins to move towards you at a very high rate of speed, the color of that light will shift more towards the blue. In fact, theoretically, you could start with a galaxy that is red, and it could be moving towards you so quickly, the light will actually look blue. On the other hand, if the galaxy is moving away from you, the color of the light that's emitted from that galaxy will shift more towards the red. Conversely, from the example I gave before, if you were to start out with a galaxy that's blue in color, theoretically, if you could move that galaxy away from you fast enough, the color would shift to the red. And it's the shift towards the blue or towards the red that we use the terms redshift and blue shift. And so the interesting thing, if I may use that terminology now, that Slipper found, whose work was carried on by Hubble, was that beyond a certain distance from our own galaxy, all the galaxies were redshifted. All the galaxies had colors that were shifted towards the red. And the other thing is interesting, the farther away the galaxies were, the faster they were moving from us, away from us. Here's a situation. Over here on the left, in this particular column, you see pictures of galaxies. The closer ones are on top, and the fainter ones on the bottom. Because they are farther and farther away, the ones on the bottom look fainter. Over here is the distance to the galaxies, and they range from 50 million light years to about 2.5 billion light years away. Let me explain a little bit what a light year is. The term light year sounds like time. It sounds like when I say one light year, it almost sounds like a period of time. In reality, it is a length. It is a distance. It is the distance that light travels in one year. And if you take light that travels 186,000 miles per second, and multiply by the number of seconds in a year, what you'll wind up with is about 6 trillion miles. Now, astronomers hate writing a bunch of zeros. So instead of saying an object is 6 trillion miles away, what we say is it is one light year away. Now, if you take a look at this galaxy in the Virgo cluster, it is 50 million light years away. What that means is it is so far away that it took the light 50 million years to reach us. Now, something else is a parenthetical remark. What that means is the galaxy that is being observed up here is seen as it was 50 million years ago. That galaxy could have disappeared from the face of the universe for all we know. We wouldn't know it for 50 million years, okay? So you see how that goes. Now, that particular galaxy is moving at a rather speedy rate of 750 miles per second. That's worse than 309 on the way to Philadelphia. Okay, so 50 million light years away, we've got 750 miles per second. Next, we go to a galaxy that is 650 million light years away, and the speed has jumped to 9,300 miles per second. And what you see is this nice correlation between an increase in distance and the increase in the speed of the object. And the way this is done, you'll see little arrows here on the right, and the length of that arrow actually gives you the amount of shifting of the light towards the red. And the more that shift is, the faster the object is moving away from us, until we get to the point of this particular galaxy, which is 2,600,000,000 light years away, and it is moving at a nice speedy rate of 38,000 miles per second. These things are really flying. And when you make a plot to see the interaction between the distance and the speed at which the galaxies are moving away from us, we find something like this. Over on the left, along the vertical line, you have the speed in miles per hour from a mere 100 million miles per hour up to 400 million miles per hour. And then over here to the right, we have the distance in light years, 1 billion out to 4 billion. And if you were to take all the points that have been plotted now that have been observed from different galaxies, which now is in the hundreds, if not the thousands, what you find is these lie along a straight line. And what it means is, what I've said before, the farther out we go, the faster the object is moving away from us. Hubble is the one who discovered this law, and it is called Hubble's Law. Hubble's Law, getting back to Jastrow, the farther away a galaxy is, the faster it moves. This is the law of the expanding universe. The same law had been predicted by de Sitter on the basis of Einstein's theory of relativity. The agreement made a tremendous impression upon astronomers. Now both theory and observation pointed to an expanding universe and a beginning in time. Now, Hubble's Law, we see, is one of the great discoveries in science. It is the foundation of the scientific theory of Genesis. Okay, now who's saying this? Some raving fundamentalist, right? No, it's Jastrow, who calls himself an agnostic. He says this is the foundation of the scientific theory of Genesis, yet it is a mysterious law. Why should a galaxy recede from us at higher speeds simply because it is farther away? And let me try to explain by a time-honored analogy that astronomers have made, and that is the so-called raisin bread model. Now, I know this doesn't look much like raisin bread, but think of it as a cross-section of raisin bread. And basically what we have is the following. We have some dough, and we put raisins in, and we mix it up, and we have a fairly even distribution of raisins. Now what we're going to do, we're going to be physicists for an hour, and we're going to take this gooey mess, and we're going to let it rise. Whether you do it out of the oven or in the oven is immaterial. We're going to let it rise. And what we're going to assume is in 1 hour's time that the batter is going to rise by a factor of two. In other words, in 1 hour, we will have each side will increase by a factor of two. Okay, twice the length, twice the height, twice the depth, etc. Now, let's see, being the physicist cooks that we are, let's see what happens to several raisins. Let's see how fast they move apart in this particular exercise. And what I want to start is over here on the left. Here's one dimension of the cake. It's 12 inches. We're baking a fairly large cake here. Okay, and it's going to expand to 24 inches because we have to feed this crowd at the end of the talk. And here we start with two raisins that are 2 inches apart. And at the end of 1 hour of baking, they're going to be 4 inches apart. Okay, so how far have those two raisins moved in 1 hour? 2 inches. We started at 2, we ended at 4. 2 inches, okay? So the two raisins are moving away at the speedy rate of 2 inches an hour. Let's start with these other raisins over here. These two raisins were 8 inches apart to begin with, and since the loaf now has expanded by a factor of 2, they are now going to be 16 inches apart. Okay, they start at 8. They end at 16 in 1 hour's time. How fast have they moved apart? Hey, this is a sharp group here. I didn't know we were going to have a bunch of mathematicians here tonight. It would have made it more complicated. Okay, so notice what has happened. The two raisins that were the farthest apart actually moved the fastest after the bread or cake expanded. This is Hubble's law. Now, think of the universe as a whole as dough. Okay? Think of the universe as a whole as dough. Think of the galaxies as raisins. And now, as the universe expands, as the dough expands, it carries the raisins right along with it. And as we discussed in terms of the raisin bread theory, we can now discuss in terms of the expanding universe, the galaxies that are closest are going to move more slowly apart than the galaxies that are far away. But now let's run things in reverse. Suppose we start over here to the right with the expanded version of the dough, the baked version, the risen version. Now we ask, what happened an hour before? Well, an hour before it was smaller. Okay, what about the universe? We look at the universe as it is now, and we see Hubble's law in operation, and we ask, what happened a billion years ago? Well, a billion years ago, the universe was smaller. And a billion years before that, it was smaller. I mean, if it's expanding, it must be getting smaller if we go back in time. Well, how much can you keep going back in time? It keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And finally, we are at a point where all the material in the universe is all compressed together in a point, and I really mean a point, something even smaller than a pinhead. I know it sounds inconceivable. Something even smaller than a pinhead. And all the material of the universe and all the energy of the universe and the heat and the light that we see today is all in that point. Now, from that point, we're going to run the clock forward. It all explodes. It all gets flung out and eventually forms what we see. That point, that instant at which the universe began to expand, blew apart, if you like, that point with incredible density, incredible energy, incredible heat and light, that time of the explosion is what we call the Big Bang. Here's a little diagram that tries to show it. We have the Big Bang. The material moves away from the Big Bang. As the universe expands, it begins to cool down. As it cools down, some very strange particles that we're not familiar with in ordinary life begin to form and then glop together, and you finally get the material that you see today forming, neutrons, protons, electrons. As the universe continues to cool down, these neutrons and protons and electrons group together as atoms. Atoms group together as clusters of atoms that form stars, that form galaxies, that form planets, and the material that's on the planets. And so you see from the Big Bang, you get a progression of the increase of the distance between the galaxies that keeps going and going, and now they're gone. Well, actually, one of the big questions today in Big Bang cosmology is what will actually happen to the galaxies? I mean, all things being equal, will the universe continue to expand until everything has expanded away from everything else, or will there be a moment where it will stop and then come back in on itself? More on that towards the end of the talk. Well, a number of people really disliked this theory. They disliked it because it pointed to a beginning. And several of the individuals who disliked it are the following. First of all, Fred Hoyle, rather famous and brilliant British physicist, along with a colleague and friend, Tom Gold, and then another person, Herman Bondi, whose picture I don't have, they came up with a way to have their cake and eat it too. No pun intended. But basically, they acknowledged the fact that the universe was expanding, but they still wanted to have an infinitely old universe. And so what they said is the following. They proposed the steady state theory. They said, sure, the universe is expanding. However, as the galaxies move away from one another, the space in between gets filled by material that pops into existence out of nothing, by nothing. That material accumulates in the galaxies. Those galaxies begin to move apart. When they move apart, new material in the space that is evacuated by them pops into existence, out of nothing, by nothing, and this process now has continued from forever. And so to use the raisin cake model, basically what happens is you have some process such that as the cake continues to expand, somehow raisins keep popping into existence. And then they expand away and more raisins pop into existence. Now, I heard Tom Gold give a talk on this, and one of the questions that was raised is, well, where did this material come from? I mean, after all, in physics we have a law called the conservation of matter and energy that says matter and energy cannot be created or destroyed, but it can be transformed. And so he was asked, where do you get this material that is forming out of nothing by nothing? Aren't you violating a very basic physical law? And his answer was, I'm getting it exactly the same place as you Big Bang theorists get it from. Because in Big Bang cosmology, you're getting something out of nothing too, right? If you're just talking about natural process. And so he said, you may think of this as a miracle, and he says, the Big Bang, the steady state universe, the steady state cosmology, steady state theory, yes, believes in a bunch of little miracles. You have a bunch of little miracles of the creation of matter out of nothing by nothing. He says, but the Big Bang, you have a big miracle. You have a big creation of material out of nothing. But I hasten to add, of course, we don't believe in miracles. But either way, you have to explain the fact that there is matter in the universe. So either you're going to get it all at once, or you're going to get it little by little. And so what he was getting at is that philosophically, there was really no difference between Big Bang cosmology and steady state cosmology. Both of them needed, quote, a miracle, end quote, in order to get the material. Well, here's basically the difference between Big Bang and steady state. The Big Bang is shown on the top row, where you start out with the galaxies that are fairly close together. As the expansion continues, they get farther and farther apart, and then continue to get farther apart. Whereas in the steady state theory, the number of galaxies that you see per volume of the universe remains the same 10 billion years ago now, 10 billion years in the future. This is the way it was from eternity past to eternity future. A prediction that is made, something that is written down, gets lost in the literature, and nobody knows it's there until a great discovery is made that's based on it. Then people search back through the literature and find that it was really there all the time. That particular theory was the following. If the Big Bang really occurred, and we have a time in the past where the universe was smaller and much hotter, we ought to be able to see some remnants of that heat today. Now let me just give you an analogy. Suppose you go to a campground. There's nobody there, but you wanted to know whether the night before there were anybody camping there, there were people camping there, and you want to see if they lit fires. Okay, there's nobody there to ask. How are you going to check to see if any fires were lit? Yeah, find a fire pit. What are you going to do with the fire pit? See what heat's in it, right. Because even though you don't have the blazing fire you had the night before, you ought to see some remnant of the heat. The rocks around the campfire will be heated. Perhaps there'll be some embers there. Well, that is the analogy that was used by George Gamow, pictured here on the right, a rather brilliant Russian physicist, and his cohorts, who also did some other work with them, Ralph Alpher and Robert Hermann. And basically they said, if the Big Bang has occurred, it is like having an enormous campfire in the past. We ought to be able to see some of the remnants of that campfire today. And so what they said is, we ought to be able to detect this remnant glow, the afterheat, if you like, from the great campfire in the past. Now, several attempts were made to do this, but none of them were successful. And that may be one reason why this particular theory was forgotten. Forgotten until the work of these two individuals, Arno Penzias on the right and Robert Wilson on the left, and the strange antenna that you see in the background. Penzias and Wilson were working for Bell Labs over here at Murray Hill across the Delaware River, and they were trying to make antennas that were very quiet so that they could pick up faint signals, clean, clear signals from satellites. No matter what they did, they kept finding a residual noise in their antenna. If you were to hook it up to a radio receiver, you'd hear a hiss. Just a constant hiss, constant noise. They tried everything. They thought at first maybe it was interference from nearby communities, electrical interference. It wasn't that. They found that no matter where they pointed this antenna in the sky, the noise was the same. They came out and took a look at the antenna and found that there were pigeons that were living in it. So they booted out the pigeons, threw out their nets, scraped off the pigeon guano from the antenna. They claim it helped a little bit. But the noise was still there. Well, they didn't quite know what to do with it until somebody at Princeton recognized the work that Penzias and Wilson were doing, and some individuals at Princeton, basically Robert Dickey and James Peebles, were reinventing the wheel that was invented back in the 40s by Gamow, Hermann, and Alpher. That is, they had recomputed what the remnant radiation should be, what this remnant heat should be from the Big Bang. And when they got together with Penzias and Wilson, Penzias and Wilson recognized that they had stumbled upon the remnant heat of the Big Bang. And not only was the heat there, but the spectrum of the heat, here they are a little later, they won Nobel Prize for this, by the way, the spectrum of the heat, that is the amount of heat at different pitches or at different frequencies, also matched what was predicted earlier by Gamow, Alpher, and Hermann, and then later by Peebles and Dickey. And nothing in steady-state cosmology could explain this. And as I said, almost overnight, steady-state cosmology was overthrown, and Big Bang cosmology received a great shot in the arm in this second major piece of evidence that supports the Big Bang theory. The first is the expanding universe. The second is this remnant radiation from the mighty campfire that was in the past. Well, at this point, enter COBE. A series of measurements were made from the Earth after Penzias and Wilson. This curve, the spectrum that was predicted by the researchers that I mentioned is shown here in blue. And basically, a number of Earth measurements, some rocket measurements, some balloon measurements were able to fit in more points besides the one fit in by Penzias and Wilson. But there was always a question as to what happened in various parts of this curve, because various parts of this curve depend upon measuring the radiation coming from the universe in frequencies, pitches, wavelengths that are not easily observed from on Earth. COBE gave us the chance to observe the entire curve, the entire spectrum, and this is what it looked like. Here you have just a little different configuration of the curve, the black line, like so, and then these little squares on here represent measurements taken by COBE, and lo and behold, they were right on. Now, that's a very powerful prediction that is in favor of Big Bang cosmology. Well, the problem, however, was after a couple of years of measuring, COBE was beginning to find a rather disturbing fact, and that is that the remnant radiation that it was picking up was a little too smooth. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. Suppose you have a campground and you had various fires in the campground. Now, suppose you go close to one fire pit and you measure that there is heat given off from it, but in order to be sure that there was a fire there and that it wasn't just the sun that was beating on it particularly fiercely the day before and you have remnant heat as a result of that, and in order to be sure that there was a fire in there, what you would like to be able to do is actually feel the heat coming from individual poles. If you feel the heat coming from individual poles, then you know that there was really a fire there. And basically, the big campfire in the sky back at creation also had poles, basically as follows. Here you have a sequence of pictures that illustrate what we feel has happened since the Big Bang. First of all, you have very smooth universe. That is, the matter is smoothly distributed throughout the universe. However, what's going to happen as a result of various fluctuations, some of this material is going to begin to coalesce. Let me give you an example of that kind of coalescing. Suppose you have steam. Okay, what happens if you begin to cool down steam? What do you get? water. You get water droplets. So you can have a container that's warm, and you can have steam in that container, evenly distributed throughout that container. But then as the container begins to cool and water molecules begin to accumulate together, group together, and you get water vapor. You get droplets of water. And this is an analogy that shows what we feel has occurred in after the Big Bang. After the smooth distribution of the material that was created in the Big Bang, it should glop together into material that eventually would form the galaxies that we see. These are like coals in the fireplace. And Kobe initially was able to pick up the general heat given off, but in order to be sure that the Big Bang was correct, the Big Bang theory was correct, it would have been nice to be able to pick up the heat from the individual coals. And lo and behold, that is exactly what Kobe was able to do, as is shown in this particular map. The red spots represent warmer areas of the sky. This band across here represents an addition of material that's radiation that's coming from our galaxy. But the top and bottom of this diagram, you can see some warmer areas that are in red and some cooler areas that are in blue. In this spotty appearance, this mottled appearance that Kobe detected is really a detection of the coals of the Big Bang, the early material out of which the galaxies form. And that is what all the excitement now has been with Kobe. Not only showing the remnant radiation, but the details of that remnant radiation. Now, we'll see as more and more data are analyzed whether this holds up. But at this point, it appears that these particular results are really quite valid. And so what we have is the following, going to the diagram that was in that May 492 issue of Time. You're over here on the right today, and we are looking in the past to the Big Bang. Now remember, the farther out we look with our telescopes or with our satellites, the more we are looking into the past. And here, Kobe is looking back at radiation at a period that was about 300,000 after, 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And the diagram that you see here is based on what we saw previously from Kobe. The red spots represent warmer areas. The blue spots represent cooler areas. It is these large structures that eventually condense into galaxies that Kobe saw. And that is what the excitement, I repeat, that's what the excitement is all about. And here's what else is interesting. Not only have these temperature differences been seen, but the temperature differences in amount are what was predicted by various forms of Big Bang cosmology. Well, briefly, what has been the reaction of scientists and theologians to this kind of material? I go back to some material that Jastrow brings up along with an update. He says, theologians generally are delighted with the proof that the universe had a beginning, but astronomers are curiously upset. The reactions provide an interesting demonstration of the response of the scientific mind, supposedly a very objective mind, when evidence uncovered by science itself leads to a conflict with the articles of faith of our profession. You saw this in Einstein's case. It turns out that the scientist behaves the way the rest of us do when our beliefs are in conflict with the evidence. We become irritated. We pretend the conflict does not exist, or we paper it over with meaningless phrases. And here are some of the reactions from the past and from today. Sir Arthur Eddington, who was a great supporter of Einstein, really found the whole idea of a beginning rather repugnant. He says in 31, I have no axe to grind in this discussion, but the notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous. Incredible, it leaves me cold. Eddington, however, made no bones about his atheism. And for the chemists in the crowd, a rather well-known chemist by the name of Walter Nernst, I realize for the rest of us it's not exactly a household term, but he said the following, to deny the infinite duration of time would be to betray the very foundations of science. No, what betrays the very foundation of science is to have evidence that favors a position and ignoring it. That's what betrays the very foundation of science. And then Philip Morrison, a fellow at MIT, maybe you've seen him on some of the PBS programs, he said the following, he says, I find it hard to accept the Big Bang Theory. I would like to reject it. And then a fellow by the name of Alan Sandage, who continued the work of Edwin Hubble even unto this day, who, by the way, appears to have become a Christian, said the following: it is such a strange conclusion, it cannot really be true. You see, this emphasis in the scientific community, among various members of the scientific community, they see the evidence, they don't like it. Well, more recently, there was this article that appeared in Physics Today: Cosmic God Squad comes under fire. And the Cosmic God Squad were people like George Smoot, principal investigator of COBE, who made statements like, it's like looking at God, that is finding this structure to the Big Bang radiation. Here's another article: in the glow of a cosmic discovery, scientists pondered God and fame. And in the same article, there's an interesting quotation by a co-worker of George Smoot, a fellow by the name of Rainier Weiss, and he says the following. He says, well, this is actually the writer saying this, and then I'll quote what Rainier Weiss says: cosmology has a way of getting confused with religion because they confront similar questions about the beginning and the end of the universe. So perhaps it's no surprise that Smoot's comment struck a chord with some of science communicators. But for the same reason, he struck a nerve with his fellow scientists. Quote, that's poison, end quote, says COBE team member Rainier Weiss about the religious connection. Quote, I wish to hell they'd never gotten near it, end quote. Again, this very objective kind of terminology that you find when this particular discussion comes up. Well, we have found what the situation, what the world was like, what the universe was like some 300,000 years after the Big Bang. Can we make observations closer to the Big Bang? Let's say just a few years after the Big Bang, a few seconds after the Big Bang? The answer is no, for reasons that I won't get into. But theoretically, we can study that period of time. But we'll never be sure that our theory is correct because of the restriction of being able to make measurements of what was present back beyond the 300,000-year barrier that I was talking about. Now, keep that in mind as I read the following. Jastrow ends with the following: now, we would like to pursue that inquiry, that is, what happened closer to the time of the Big Bang. We would like to pursue that inquiry back in time, but the barrier to further progress seems insurmountable. That's what I just mentioned. It is not a matter of yet another year, another decade of work, another measurement, or another theory. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation, that is, to give a full scientific explanation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. The theologians had no problem with fake creation. We end with the following question. Is this statement true? Thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thine hands. This is Psalm 102, verse 19. It is repeated again in Hebrews. What is the answer to that question? Is it true? Yes, it is. Not only because the scriptures tell us so, but recently there has been some very powerful evidence that leads that way as well. And so we find something which I have always believed in and will continue to believe in, and that is we have two revelations from God. One revelation is what we call the Bible. The other revelation is what we call nature. Science is a method of uncovering what the facts of nature are. Theology, exegesis, is a methods of uncovering what the Bible says. And since we have the same author for the Bible, the book of God's words, and the same author for nature, the book of God's works, we should expect to find a correlation. And here, in the very matter of origins, we find a rather spectacular correlation. Thank you very much for your attention.